Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Always nice to have this hour to share with you. Today, how walnuts can lower your cardiovascular disease risk by boosting the endothelial function. This is a meta-analysis from the Shenzhen Center for Disease Control. And very important, but a little scientific. I'll explain it in lay language. That's just one of many studies, also from Johns Hopkins University. Higher selenium and manganese levels during pregnancy can protect your baby from future high blood pressure. That's important. And also, why the new World Health Organization study links moderate, just small amounts of alcohol, to higher cancer risk. And this is from the International Agency for Research on Cancer. I wrote a book on alcohol 45 years ago. It was called Alcohol Nutrition. It's out of print. And in it, I stated that no amount of alcohol is good. And yet there was an argument that, well, a small amount of alcohol is good, moderate. Well, what is moderate? You know, it's like saying moderation in all things. What exactly does that mean? No two people have the same concept of how much is a moderate amount of sugar, how much exposure to a pesticide is moderate, how much of the electromagnetic frequencies through cell phones and computers, and in your car. Remember, when you're in your car and you're being tracked by Google and it can show you every place you've gone, how long you stayed, well, that's because there's an electromagnetic pulse beam that's coming down to the car from a satellite. That means that you're being affected by that. When you're in a car and you turn on a radio, well, you're able to get things depending upon the strength of that signal. You're in a room and you hear nothing. Now you bring in a radio, you can hear things. Well, if that is grounded or not grounded, you can be impacted. Smart meters, you shouldn't allow any smart meters anywhere near you, especially on your home. I came back from New York 2 years ago, and it was just a coincidence that I saw someone leaving, and I said, we shouldn't be having anything. I shouldn't pay anything because I have my whole house is solar powered. It has been one of the first in all of Southwest Florida. Oh, no, I was just checking your smart meter. What smart meter? I didn't ask for a smart meter. Take it out of here. I had to go through a whole process of writing the company to get that out. That's a source of cancer. But you wouldn't know that from the mainstream media. Also from Ohio State University, a diet rich in tomatoes cuts skin cancer risk by 50%. Well, consider how many people live in states that give them abundance of sun, and we have a lot of squamous cell and basal cell and other forms of skin cancer. That's important. So we have a lot to share on health, but also we have a lot to share on other topics. For example, I'm going to share information that the media is right now, in fact, the White House officially is saying that if you provide misinformation, you should be banned from all sources. You shouldn't have any voice at all. And then she went on to talk about how the White House has been working with Facebook and other platforms, social platforms, to ban anyone. Well, they don't just ban you. They then attack you. They put the government on you. They put the Justice Department, Internal Revenue Service. They're notorious for being able to weaponize their power against those that they do not like. Is that fair? It's not fair, and it's not realistic. So we're going to go into that in some depth today. So we have a lot to share and a lot of interesting clips that I'm going to play for you also. All this ties together, and then I'll give you my own commentary on it. I have two commentaries. One I finished early this morning. I'm sure my friends wonder when I sleep because I sent it out. I sent out 2:30, 3, 3:30, and 4. But that's when sometimes I just wake up and I have an idea and I sit and I write it out. I'm going to present that on tomorrow's program. Before we get to those topics, let's take a look at one of the most deadly cancers, one of the most feared cancers, and that is pancreatic cancer. We generally don't hear a lot about pancreatic cancer unless someone like a Luciano Pavarotti gets it, Dizzy Gillespie, Patrick Swayze, Michael Landon, Gene Upshaw, Carl Langerfeld, Bob Gibson, the famous Hall of Famer, baseball great, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Aretha Franklin, John Lewis, the congressperson who died in 2020, Alex Trebek. If you're famous and you have pancreatic cancer, we hear about it. If you're not famous, nobody hears about it. So here's the question. Why do we have a rise in pancreatic cancers when overall there's been a decline? Well, it's simple. We've had a decline in risk factors because of tobacco use. It plummeted between the 1960s and 70s. And yet pancreatic cancer cases are not declining. And I believe that we have to take it simple. I'm not going to go into a long and detailed protocol, but we have had very little success with the surgery for pancreatic cancer. It's called the Alan Whipple, that's W-H-I-P-P-L-E, devised a more effective way of removing a section of the pancreas and also removed a section of the gallbladder and small intestine, the bile duct, and the stomach. So needless to say, that was not good for the patient. In fact, even in 2021, it's severe with a higher death rate compared to many other types of surgery. So that was what medicine was told to use, and that's what they used. And unfortunately, it didn't help the outcome. And yet we have had good outcomes in other areas, mainly because of prevention, what we're no longer doing. So what could we do? And the chemotherapy is not the answer either, because if you look at the best studies they have, including the 2018 study in the New England Journal of Medicine, it compared chemotherapy using either one of two of the fluorouracil with luvavirin and about four different chemotherapies as a combination against another one. And there was a medium follow-up of 33.6 months in the medium disease and 21 months in another group. That's not a long time survival. And a lot of that is fraught with a lot of pain, going bald, losing weight, and being susceptible to other infections because it's your immune system that's being crippled. Chemotherapy destroys your immune system. Most do. So what is our answer? How about something based upon Occam's razor? Go to the heart of it, what you want to get to. And that is, we're not encouraging the citizens of the United States to lose weight. We have all kinds of diets, but those are gimmicks. Those are for-profit diets. And if you look at the foods, they're saying, oh, I can continue to eat my favorite food, and as if there's a cognitive disconnect. But what if your favorite food is pro-inflammatory? The meat, the pizzas, the sugary desserts. Then you're giving someone a caloric restriction, which will cause some weight loss, but you're also making them more susceptible to diseases. So the top of the list of things that can cause pancreatic cancer is being overweight and being diabetic. So we're talking about surging numbers of overweight and obese Americans. In fact, half of all adults in the United States are pre-diabetic or have type 2 diabetes. Now, compared to normal weight people, obese individuals have about a 50% increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer, as well as overall survival rates, much lower. That's about the same risk of cigarette smokers, which helps explain why pancreatic cancer incidence is not declining despite reductions in tobacco use. Because if you reduce your tobacco use and then you begin to take a plant-based diet, you're going to reduce your risk almost nothing. But as a country, we just refuse to do that. We're just not willing to make that commitment. And it's not because the science isn't there. I have thousands of studies on the role of diet and disease. I have no studies that support an unhealthy diet as helping prevent disease or lengthen your lifespan. I don't see any scientific study anywhere in a peer-reviewed journal or on PubMed that says, eat bacon and live a longer life. You know, have 300 grams of sugar today in the form of fructose or any form of glucose or sucrose, and live an extra 10 years. So what you're talking about is you're talking about a healthy pancreas or healthy heart, healthy lung. Healthy lungs are important. You're not going to have healthy lungs if you smoke or you drink. You're going to have inflamed lungs, inflamed kidney. Every time you drink alcohol, inflammation of five organs. So first, I'm going to give to the simplest way I can approach this. Mind you, this is the simplest way. A, lose the weight. How? Go on a healthy, living food diet. Lots of fresh juices. Lots of exercise. Participate in mindful meditation and yoga, tai chi, and other ways of reducing stress. Get up and walk fast as you can, at least four times a day, 10 minutes. That would do you a lot of good. Go vegan. In fact, a very large, well-designed United Kingdom study published in 2014 on the death for pancreatic cancer, it was lower for those who were not eating the meat all the time, 45% lower. And if you were vegan, it was more than 50% lower death rate. So that's important. And yet we keep saying, eat the meat, lots of it, in all kinds of terrible combinations, and get it inexpensively. So that's number one, lose the weight, control your blood sugar, and you've got 50% of battle won. Then look at what is the most important nutrient to help prevent this. Wouldn't be vitamin C, as you would think. It's magnesium. The studies show that if you're taking just 200 milligrams of magnesium, you're actually going to have an increase of 24% in the risk of pancreatic cancer. I'm suggesting taking 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams divided into two doses, half in the morning, half in the afternoon, or early evening. Because when you start taking more than the recommended daily allowance of magnesium, you have an enormous drop in your incidence of pancreatic cancer. That's important. So look for getting your magnesium. I suggest about 400 to 500 milligrams per serving. Also, in fact, those who ingested more than the government's recommended dietary allowance had a 42% greater risk of pancreatic cancer incidence compared to those, I mean, up to 100%. So they were not taking a lot. All these government recommendations are absolutely stupid. There's no science behind any of them. So that's how you do it. Even if you've tested positive for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, which these are supposed to be the mutations that are hereditary. And so we have at least 80% that are not, meaning 80% of our cancers, including pancreatic cancer, we could modulate. Now, I'm not even talking about all the other things like vitamin C and selenium that we could take that could make a difference. I'm just telling you what you should take to get people into a better frame of mind. Because if you tell people to change everything, take all the supplements, do all the exercise, they're not going to do it. They're just not. They never have. They won't. We've had 100 years of millions of words written about healthier lifestyle, and we only have 7% of the American population following the advice. So it's not a deficiency of advice, quality advice. It's just the human element of resisting that which causes discomfort. We have our comfort lifestyle, comfort clothes, comfort television programs, and we're not going to change. So that's one place I wouldn't put my energy, knowing that, as Lao Tzu said in The Art of War, choose your battles, the ones you are likely to win. So one way we can help ourselves is by eating walnuts, according to the study. Consuming walnuts, a handful of walnuts each day, could help lower the risk of cardiovascular diseases by improving your endothelial function. And also it's good if you take almonds, hazelnuts, and pistachios. Now, you won't get as good an impact, but those are good for you for other reasons, but the top nut, walnuts. Now, we've known for a long time, with lots of studies, that the more nuts that you eat, raw nuts, the lower your risk of cardiovascular disease and its effect on the endothelial function. It's what we call a prognostic marker of cardiovascular disease. And endothelial dysfunction is an event in the early stage of atherosclerosis and an independent predictor of further cardiovascular disease events. So they took a look at 10 randomized controlled trials using flow-mediated dilation as a measurement of endothelial function. Let me just make this real simple. Let's just say you have a water hose, brand new. It's flexible. Now, put it out in the sun for a month, in the hot sun, and it's dry and brittle. That's what happens when you start eating the average American diet, drinking the soft drinks, having the sugar, having the pizzas, the ice cream, and all the stuff you normally have. You create damage to your endothelial. That, in turn, adversely affects your entire blood circulatory system. So walnuts go to work with the oils they have, and they end up helping your endothelium. Now, there are other things also help the endothelium. A lot of other nutrients do, but I'm not dealing with that right now. Your walnuts contain a lot of the omega-3 vegan or plant-based fatty acids and the ALAs, and that increases the membrane fluidity of endothelial cells and reduces endothelial inflammation. Walnuts turn off the inflammation in your body. And though blood pressure and lipid profiles are known to be traditional risk factors in cardiovascular disease, endothelial dysfunction is right at the top of the list. And that's what you want. And by the way, vitamin C is terrific for helping your endothelial, as is vitamin E. So take those together with your walnuts. You want those tocopherols, T-O-C-O, tocoph, P-H-E-R-O-L, tocopherols, with trotocotrienols, and that reduces the severity of atherosclerosis. So just trying to have you live a longer life. And one last thing here from Johns Hopkins University. You should be taking between 200 to 400 micrograms, MCG, micrograms, not milligrams, micrograms, of selenium and 5 milligrams of manganese if you're pregnant. And that, the 200 micrograms of selenium, 5 micrograms of manganese, can help protect babies from future high blood pressure. That's good news. And that was published in the Environmental Health Perspectives. And I'll do one more here. This is from the International Agency for Research on Cancer. It's a new study from the World Health Organization's interagency. And it was published in the Lancet Oncology, a major peer-reviewed journal for cancer. And it found an association between alcohol and the substantially higher risk of several forms of cancer, including breast cancer, colon cancer, and oral cancers. And increased the risk was evident even among very light, very moderate drinkers. So stay off alcohol altogether, and you help prevent those cancers. Simple. It's not complicated. Oh, and by the way, a diet rich in tomatoes cuts skin cancer risk in this laboratory experiment, Ohio State University. So get more tomatoes, tomato juice, make your own tomato purees, make your own tomato sauces. All right? I take tomatoes, and I'll boil water, and I'll dip in for like 60 seconds the tomato. Take it out, blanch it, peel off the skin, put it in a blender. I'll throw in some horseradish, maybe a half a teaspoon. I'll throw in some fresh ginger and some garlic and some raw onion. And then I build that up to where I have a whole, let's say, what would be 2 16-ounce glasses, so 32 ounces. And then I drink that throughout the day. It's delicious. Every single thing in there turns off inflammation and helps heal and has antiviral and antibacterial qualities. This study was published in Scientific Reports. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break. When we come back from the break here, I want to go through a few things that I'm concerned with about what information you're not getting at a time when the official information has become universally controlled, meaning whatever you hear on CNN, you're going to hear in every other media outlet in any form, as if they're all reading from the same script, which, by the way, they are. And then I'll have my commentary behind that. Stay with us. Back in a moment. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting through our studios, the Progressive Radio Voices, using the Progressive Radio Network studios in New York City. You're only going to know, if you're the average person, what the media tells you. And we trusted, in my generation, Walter Cronkite, David Brinkley, Chet Huntley. We believed them. We trusted Jack Anderson, the whistleblower, for all things wrong, or a cipher for whistleblowers. But today, people have their favorites, understandable. Either it's almost always either on the conservative side or the liberal side. But what about the truth? Where is it? And what if you begin to believe in things that cause fear and you make decisions that can be extremely deadly? This morning, I received an email from one of the listeners, a citizen journalist, and it was a video. The video was of a doctor, a woman on a show, talking about a blood sample that had been taken, was called a blood smear, and it showed defects. One was a normal blood, and she explained, and the other was defective. So I watched it, and if you were the average person who saw it, it would scare you because it showed all these defects in the blood of the person getting the coronavirus, and that's the coronavirus materials in a person's blood. So I wrote back the person, says, where's your source? And what is the credential? This woman keeps being called a doctor. Generally, when someone is called a doctor involving medical issues, she's a medical or he's a medical physician. I could find no background that supported this person being a medical doctor, nor could I find the credentials supporting that she was an actual PhD, though one listed her as having two PhDs. From where? In what fields? Couldn't find that. I did find that she graduated University of Rochester in nursing and went on to become a nurse practitioner. Okay, that's fine, but that's not a doctor. So maybe she has that, but I couldn't find it. And nowhere in the introduction was her academic background spelled out, which at least gives some confidence that a person's talking on a subject that they know something about. It doesn't mean that she's ignorant. It means that I need more information. And also, I couldn't find anything on the doctor who supposedly gave her this material, nothing that's more than like 20 years ago. This guy did something in the field of homeopathy. So before I would take that and say this is important, I would first have to confirm that it's real, reproducible, and from a quality source. Here's the problem. It's a catch-22. A lot that goes on in the internet is not fully accurate. It may have some accuracy, but until it's confirmed by people who are actually authorities in the field, who have no political or ideological or financial agenda, they're simply looking at something in a field that they are in, they know the language, they know what to look for, they know the weaknesses in systems, and they can say this is credible or not credible, then we could be victims of some propaganda. Also, what you're finding is most of this information on alternative approaches now are coming from right-wing sites, politically right-wing. Now, in and of itself, that doesn't make something wrong, but it does mean it's very much open to bias, just as the left has been extremely biased in its reporting of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and other drugs that we could be using, should have been using, and didn't because it was a political and economic agenda. I'll be proving that in talk commentary I'm sharing tomorrow with full references. So I wrote back and I said, I cannot tell people that this is real because I have no independent corroboration. I have not been able to speak with the person who gave you this information. And was this one patient or was this 10 patients or 100 patients? And what systems were used? What analysis was used? You know, none of that existed. So please do not rush to believe that everything that goes out there on the internet is legitimate. Now, here's the catch-22. The legitimate people who do their homework, who have credible information, the mainstream journalists who have now looked for the truth, found it, and are not willing to keep it censored, and the doctors and scientists, legitimate, mainstream, they're blocked from all social platforms. And Google will not put an algorithm, a search together for them, so nobody knows they've made a major discovery. For example, over the weekend, 500,000 people in France protested, and rightly so, that if you're caught in a diner someplace without a mask, you can go to jail for 6 months based upon this person who runs the country, Macron, who came from, you know, the whole World Bank Davos conclave. And it's a wrong approach. Not a word. 500,000 people marched 2 weeks ago Saturday in London peacefully, not even keynote speakers. Not a word. 1 million people protest in Berlin. They had over 30 speakers, none of them neo-Nazis, none of them right-wing fanatics, all of them with good backgrounds. Not a word. And only word was that these were a few thousand people, mainly neo-Nazis. Intentional disinformation. So what happens is this. If you're a credible person who's always had a good reputation in a 20, 30, 40, 50-year career, and you can't get something on the media, nobody will have you on to debate what you consider wrong, then you're going to go on any site you can. So they end up on sites that are ones I never take information from because I know how absolutely biased they are. That then allows the establishment to say, see, they're over there on Alex Jones, or they're over there one of these other, you know, places that have no credibility. So put yourself in their shoes. Where do you go? You can go on Brett Weinstein's Dark Horse, but he has a small audience because nothing he does is ever promoted. He's been censored and thrown off all these sites. He can't promote himself. The only people who are watching him are people who already know he exists. So that's the game the establishment is playing. So I want to show you how this works. I'm going to quote verbatim from one of the world's leading immunologists. And he is, this was an article in the Swiss magazine World Week. And he is Dr. Beda, that's B-E-D-A, M. Stadler. S-T-A-D-L-E-R. He is the former director of the Institute of Immunology at the University of Bern. He is also a biologist, and he is also professor emeritus, the highest award that academia can give to a former alumni for outstanding contributions to their field. So he's everything the establishment says is the best. Head of a department, biologist, immunologist, professor, emeritus, published in peer-reviewed literature at University of Bern, a heavyweight university. So that we have is what his background is. You would think that people in the media would want to have him come on and debate others. Not true. I'm going to quote verbatim. And tell me, I'm going to ask you to call in and give me your feedback, what this means to you in better understanding COVID. Quote, "This is not an accusation, but a ruthless taking stock of the current situation. I could slap myself because I looked at COVID or SARS-2 way too long with panic. I am also somewhat annoyed with many of my immunology colleagues who so far have left the discussion about COVID-19 to virologists and epidemiologists. I feel it is time to criticize some of the main and completely wrong public statements about this virus. Firstly, it was wrong to claim that this virus was novel. Secondly, it was even more wrong to claim that the population would not already have some immunity against this virus. And thirdly, it was the crowning of stupidity to claim that someone could have COVID-19 without any symptoms at all, or even pass the disease along without showing any symptoms whatsoever. But let's look at this one by one. One, a new virus. At the end of 2019, a coronavirus, which was considered novel, was detected in China. When the gene sequence, i.e. the blueprint of the virus, was identified and was given a similar name to the 2002 identified SARS, i.e. SARS-CoV-2, we should have already asked ourselves then how far this virus is related to other coronaviruses which can make human beings sick. But no. Instead, we discussed from which animal, as part of a Chinese menu, the virus might have sprung. In the meantime, however, many more people believe the Chinese were so stupid as to release this virus upon themselves in their own country. Now that we're talking about developing a vaccine against the virus, we suddenly see studies which show that this so-called novel virus is very strongly related to SARS-1, as well as other beta coronaviruses, which make us suffer every year in the form of colds. Apart from the pure information in the sequence between the various coronaviruses which can make people sick, scientists currently work on identifying a number of areas on the virus in the same way as human immune cells identify them. This is no longer about the genetic relationship, but about our own immune systems seeing this virus, i.e., which parts of other coronaviruses could potentially be used in a vaccine. So SARS-2 isn't at all that new, but merely a seasonal cold virus that mutated and disappears in summer, as all cold viruses do, which is what we're observing globally right now. Flu viruses mutate significantly more, by the way, and nobody would ever claim that a new flu virus strain was completely novel. Many veterinarian doctors were therefore annoyed by this claim of novelty, as they have been vaccinating cats, dogs, pigs, and cows for years against coronaviruses. Two, the fairy tale of no immunity. From the World Health Organization to every Facebook virologist, everyone claimed this virus was particularly dangerous because there was no immunity against it, because it was a novel virus. Even Anthony Fauci, the most important advisor to the Trump administration, noted at the beginning at every public appearance that the danger of the virus lay in the fact that there is no immunity against it. Tony and I often sat next to each other at immunity seminars at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda in the USA because we worked in related fields back then. So for a while, I was pretty uncritical of his statements since he was a respectable colleague of mine. The penny dropped only when I realized that the first commercially available antibody test for SARS-2 was put together by an old antibody test that was meant to detect SARS-1. This kind of test evaluates if there are antibodies in someone's blood and if they came about through an early fight against the virus. Scientists even extracted antibodies from a llama that would detect SARS-1, SARS-2, and even the MERS virus. It also became known as the SARS-CoV-2 had less significant impact in areas in China where SARS-1 had previously raged. This is clear evidence urgently suggesting that our immune systems consider SARS-1 and SARS-2 at least partially identical and that one virus could probably protect us from the other. That's when I realized that the entire world simply claimed that there was no immunity, but in reality, nobody had a test ready to prove such a statement. No proof. That wasn't science. That's pure speculation based upon a gut feeling that was then parroted by everybody. To this day, there isn't a single antibody test that can describe all possible immunological situations, such as if someone is immune since when, what the neutralizing antibodies are targeting, and how many structures exist on other coronaviruses that can equally lead to immunity. In mid-April, work was published by the group of Andreas Thiel at the Charité Berlin, a paper with 30 authors, amongst them the virologist Christian Drosten. It showed that in 34% of people in Berlin who had never been in contact with the SARS-2 virus showed nothing less T-cell immunity against it. T-cell immunity is a different kind of immune reaction. This means that our T-cells, meaning the white blood cells, detect common structures appearing on SARS-2 and regular cold viruses, and therefore combat them both. A study by John Leonis at Stanford University, according to the Einstein Foundation in Berlin, one of the world's 10 most cited scientists, showed that immunity against SARS-2 measured in the form of antibodies is much higher than previously thought. Leonis is certainly not a conspiracy theorist who just wants to swim against the stream. Nonetheless, he is now being criticized because the antibody tests used were not extremely precise. With that, his critics admit that they do not have such tests yet. And aside, John Leonis is such a scientific heavyweight that all German virologists combined are lightweight in comparison. Number three, the failure of modulars. Epidemiologists also fell for the myth that there was no immunity in the population. They also didn't want to believe that coronaviruses were seasonal cold viruses that would disappear in summer. Otherwise, their curve models would have looked differently when the initial worst-case scenarios didn't come true anywhere. Some now still cling to models predicting a second wave. Let's leave them their hopes. I've never seen a scientific branch that maneuvered itself so much into the offside. I have also not yet understood why epidemiologists were so much more interested in the numbers of deaths rather than the numbers that could be saved. Then number four, immunology of common sense. As an immunologist, I trust a biological model, namely that of the human organism, which was built as a tried and tested adaptive immune system. At the end of February, driving home from the recording of a Swiss debate, I mentioned to Daniel Koch, former head of the Swiss Federal Section of Communicable Diseases of the Federal Office of Public Health, that I suspected there was a general immunity in the population against SARS-2. He argued against my view. I later defended him anyway when he said that children were not a driving factor in the spread of the pandemic. He suspected that children didn't have a receptor for the virus, which is, of course, nonsense. Still, we had to admit that his observations were correct. But the fact that every scientist attacked him afterwards and asked for studies to prove his point was somewhat ironic. Nobody asked for studies to prove that people in certain at-risk groups were dying. When the first statistics from China and later worldwide data showed the same trend, that is to say that almost no children under 10 got sick, everyone should have made the argument that children clearly have to be immune. For every other disease that doesn't afflict a certain group of people, we would come to the conclusion that that group is immune. When people are sadly dying in a retirement home, but in the same place other pensioners with the same risk factors are left entirely unharmed, we should also conclude that they were presumably immune. But this common sense seems to have eluded many. Let's call them immunity deniers. I repeat, immunity deniers, just for fun. This new breed of deniers has to observe that the majority of people who tested positive for this virus, i.e. the virus was present in their throats, did not get sick. The term silent carriers was conjured out of a hat, and it was claimed that one could be sick without having symptoms. Wouldn't that be something? If this principle from now on gets naturalized into the realm of medicine, health insurers would really have a problem, but also teachers whose students could now claim to have whatever disease to skip school if at the end of the day one didn't need symptoms anymore to be sick. The next joke that some virologists shared was the claim that those who were sick without symptoms could still spread the disease virus to other people. The healthy sick would have so much of the virus in their throats that a normal conversation between two people would be enough for the healthy ones to infect the other one. At this point, we have to dissect what is happening here. If a virus is growing anywhere in the body, also in the throat, it means the human cells decrease. When human cells decrease, the immune system is alerted immediately and an infection is caused. One of the five cardinal symptoms of an infection is pain. It is understandable that those afflicted by COVID-19 might not remember that initial scratchy throat and then go on to claim that they didn't have any symptoms just a few days ago. But for doctors and virologists to twist this into a story of healthy sick people, which stokes panic and often given as a reason for stricter lockdown measures, just shows how bad the joke really is. At least the World Health Organization didn't accept the claim of asymptomatic infections and even challenges this claim on its website. Here a succinct and brief summary, especially for the immunity deniers, of how the humans are attacked by germs and how we react to them. If there are pathogenic viruses in our environment, Then all humans, whether immune or not, are attacked by this virus. If someone is immune, the battle with the virus begins. First, we try to prevent the virus from binding to our own cells with the help of antibodies. This normally works only partially. Not all are blocked, and some viruses will attach to the appropriate cells. That doesn't need to lead to symptoms, but it also is not a disease. Because the second guard of the immune system is now called into action, that's the above-mentioned T cells, white blood cells, which can determine from the outside in which other cells the virus is now hiding to multiply. These cells, which are now incubating the virus, are searched throughout the entire body and killed by the T cells until the last virus is dead. So if we do a PCR corona test on an immune person, it is not a virus that is detected, but a small shattered part of the viral genome. The test comes back positive for as long as there are tiny shattered parts of the virus left. Correct. Even if the infectious viruses are long dead, a corona test can come back positive because the PCR method multiplies even a tiny fraction of the viral genetic material enough to be detected. That's exactly what happened when there was the global news, even shared by the World Health Organization, that 200 Koreans who already went through COVID-19 were infected a second time and that there was therefore probably no immunity against the virus. The explanation of what really happened and an apology came only later, when it was clear that the immune Koreans were perfectly healthy and only had a short battle with the virus. The crux was that the virus debris registered with the overly sensitive test and therefore came back as positive. It is likely that a large number of daily reported infection numbers are purely due to dead viral debris. The PCR test, with its extreme sensitivity, was initially perfect to find out where the virus could be. But this test cannot identify whether the virus is still alive, i.e. still infectious. Unfortunately, this also led some virologists to equate the strength of a test result with viral load, the amount of virus someone can breathe out. Luckily, our daycare centers stayed open nonetheless, since German virologists missed that part, because out of principle, they do not look at what other countries are doing, even if other countries' case numbers are falling more rapidly. Five, the problem with corona immunity. What does this all mean in real life? The extremely long incubation time of 2 to 14 days and reports of 22 to 27 days should wake up any immunologist, as well as the claim that most patients would no longer secrete the virus after 5 days. Both claims, in turn, actually lead to the conclusion that there is, sort of in the background, a base immunity that contorts the events compared to an expected cycle, meaning of a virus infection, i.e., it leads to a long incubation period and quick immunity. This immunity also seems to be the problem for patients with a severe course of the disease. Our antibody titer, i.e., the accuracy of our defense system, is reduced the older we get. But also, people with a bad diet who are malnourished may have a weakened immune system, which is why this virus does not only reveal the medical problems of the country, but also social issues. If an infected person does not have enough antibodies, i.e., a weak immune response, the virus slowly spreads out across the entire body. Now that there are not enough antibodies, there's only the second supporting leg of our immune system, the T cells, begin the attack in virus-infested cells all over the body. This can lead to an exaggerated immune response, basically to a massive slaughter. This is called cytokine storm. Very rarely, this can also happen in small children. In that case, called Kwasniewski syndrome, this very rare occurrence in children was also used in our country to stoke panic. It's interesting, however, that this syndrome is very easily cured. The affected children get antibodies from healthy blood donors, i.e. people who went through coronavirus colds. This means that the hushed-up, supposedly non-existent immunity in the population is, in fact, used therapeutically. What now? In conclusion, this virus has gone on now. It will probably come back in the winter, But it won't be a second wave, but just a cold. Those young and healthy people who currently walk around with a mask on their face would be better off wearing a helmet instead, because the risk of something falling on their head is greater than that of getting a serious case of COVID-19. If we observe a significant rise in infections in 14 days after the Swiss relaxed the lockdown, we'd at least know that one of the measures was useful. Other than that, I recommend reading John Leonidas's latest work, in which he describes the global situation based upon data on May 1st, 2020. People below 65 make up only 0.6 to 2.6 of all fatal coronaviruses cases. To get on top of that, the pandemic, we need a strategy merely concentrating on the protection of at-risk people over 65. If that's the option of a top expert, a second lockdown is simply a no-go. On our way back to normal, it would be a good for us citizens if a few scaremongers apologized, such as doctors who wanted a triage of over 80-year-old COVID patients in order to stop ventilating them. Also, media that kept showing alarmist videos of Italian hospitals to illustrate a situation that was such did not exist. All politicians calling the testing, testing, testing without even knowing what the damn test is actually showing should apologize. Okay? So there you have it. One of the greatest virologists in the world, one of the most published, highly respected in immunology and virology, an emeritus professor, not a word of his work. You won't. What I just read you is the only place you're going to hear it. Okay, just to let you know, this is the game that's being played. I'd like your thoughts now. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. How we've been played. Think of all the people who, if we went into nursing homes, assisted living centers, and we gave them vitamin D and vitamin C injections, you know, build them up intravenous, gave them selenium, and gave them a healthy diet, they'd be alive today. But they're not, because we went with the protocols that the corporate agenda benefited from. And by the way, this is just in just now. Despite Anthony Fauci's assertions, Israel data indicate natural immunity 600% greater than achieved from the vaccine. This is from LifeSite. Quote, adding to a long list of studies contradicting recent statements by Joe Biden's chief medical advisor, Anthony Fauci, statistics out of Israel indicate that the immune response to those individuals who have recovered from COVID is approximately 672% greater than those who accepted the experimental vaccine injections. This was reported by Israeli National News. Data submitted to the nation's health ministry shows that COVID-19, quote, patients who recovered from the virus were far less likely to become infected than those who were vaccinated against COVID. Health ministry data on infections over the last 2 months reveals that, quote, Israelis with immunity from natural infection, just what this guy was talking about, what I just shared with you, were far less likely to become infected again in comparison to Israelis who only had immunity via the vaccination. All right? Going to hear about that anywhere today? Not at all. Nothing today. Okay? Now, as soon as calls come in, I'm going to note that. But with the idea that we should ban everyone that the administration publicly says is a carrier of misinformation permanently from all sites, you're gone, you're dead, you're out of here, you're a disgrace, get out of here. That's what she said. Okay, let's say we go along with her. Remember George Santayana's statement, history is a pack of lies about events that never happened, told by people who weren't there? Journalists today have become the very thing they love to hate. As soon as a media outlet or network becomes partisan, then objective reporting completely disappears, regardless of which side of the political line they are on. In 1844, the New York Sun first reported on the transatlantic flight in a balloon. That was a complete hoax. In 2002, the New York Times' Judith Miller, who now works with a Nuocon think tank, invented the pretext to invade Iraq. Weapons of mass destruction that included biological weapons, that led to the invasion of Iraq. That led to millions of people being thrown out, hundreds of thousands dying, and virtually the entire country, including all of the Allied forces who were there, being exposed to the very toxic depleted uranium, which were in all the munitions used. And when that bullet or bomb burst, it microcrystallizes. Interesting, because Iraqi doctors wanted to give me up to 5,000 photographs of children born, one with a cyclops eye in the middle of the head with no brain and skull, all from depleted uranium. The American media wouldn't touch it. 1994, still touting the old screed that cigarettes are no more addictive than coffee, tea and Twinkies. They were wrong. 1930s, the New York Times reported no famine in Russia when Stalin was trying to wipe out private farms in Ukraine and upwards of 6 million Ukrainians died. In 1998, Stephen Glass, New Republic reporter who created fictitious stories that never occurred for 3 years, in-game the subject of the movie Shattered Glass. In recent years, since collusion between government and media simply parrots the lies of either party or whoever is in the White House, during the past 25 years, all mainstream media have cut back on the field reporters, especially internationally. Most news outlets rely upon a handful of larger companies like Associated Press, BBC, and Reuters, who have reporters located around the world to funnel stories that then get distributed to all the networks. Still, we don't know the truth of Osama bin Laden's death. Just assume that official story is true, dumping his body out to sea. Something Stalin would have done. 2003, Jason Blair, New York Times journalist, who plagiarized and created numerous bogus stories of events that never took place, eventually diagnosed with bipolar. 2003, Bruce Williams, NBC, his take on an elaborate story of being shot down in a helicopter over Iraq. It was completely different, a different helicopter that was shot at, not the one Williams was in. Turns out that he was suspended. How about Bill O'Reilly's story about experiencing war during the Falkland War between the UK and Argentina? How about Dan Rather on CBS fabricating the story about the Bush relied upon completely fake documents that Bush refused to have a physical exam and his time in the National Guard was completely exaggerated? How about in 2006 Canada's National Post that Iran was going to color code its Jewish citizens? During Obama, the stories behind the coup in Ukraine, false. Regime change in Libya, never had to happen. In Syria, never had to happen. The drone war in Yemen, secret. All lies. Assad and chemical weapons in Syria, lies. The complete fabrication of the white helmet mythology. 2013, the ABC correspondent Jonathan Carl on the Benghazi story. We were told lies. They could have been rescued. 2014, Rolling Stone fabricated a story of fraternity gang rape of student at the University of Virginia campus. And during Obama, the New York Times, the New York Post, the CNN, Washington Post completely created a fictitious scenario of Russian aggression during the Ukraine crisis around Donbass, whitewashing neo-Nazi organizations that eventually took power in the government. One of the most telling examples of intelligence collusion with the media is that Ken Dillian, a journalist at the Los Angeles Times who was later discovered to be a CIA operative and fired, was continually downplaying the cost of innocent lives from the U.S. military operations drone attacks in the Middle East. How about Russiagate? On the right, the Pizzagate. All of the immigrants coming to the border were rapists and drug dealers and murderers. Not true. Rachel Maddow's MSNBC litany of audacious Russian hoaxes related to Trump and his colleagues. Four investigations found it all not true. But how many people in the media parroted every single day those lies? How about every single media? All right, and then Fox exaggerating the size of Trump and other GOP candidates' rallies repeatedly. In medicine, often it is the silence of what is not being spoken that is also promoting a fake news through silence. Despite all of the volumes of evidence confirming the health risk of junk and processed foods, soft drinks, meat, etc., daily it is advertised across the entire media without any intervention by the government or the media. For example, lies by the government agencies DDT and now 243 are safe. Cigarettes, safe. Alcohol, safe. Fluoride, safe. Forever chemicals that 99% of Americans have been exposed to, safe. How about glyphosate, Roundup, safe. Other toxic pesticides like atrazine on corn and on apples, oranges, and corn and almonds, metachlor on corn and soy. Vaccines don't cause autism. Court settlements by the vaccine courts show just the opposite. Dimerosal, mercury, and vaccines are not causing autism, covered up in the Simpsonwood meeting. MMR vaccine and autism. Wayne Thompson's information showed the entire CDC vaccine department was lying. Attack on the vaxxed. Before the film was released, attacks that no one had seen the film, that they were attacking it, the mainstream media. Dangerous toxic drugs still pushed on patients with federal approval, like Lipitor and Crestor, Yaz and Yasmin, birth control, Humira, and TNF blockers made from genetically engineered hamster cells, sleeping pills, Ambien, Lunesta, Sonetta, Tamoxifen for breast cancer chemotherapy, Prempro, and Premarin, Pfizer hormone drugs, and continuing to advance and subsidize the hydrofracking. And what about COVID? The medical journalists indoctrinated by the CDC and the CDC director, Rachel Walensky, pandemic of unvaccinated, based upon purely scientifically unproven hypothesis of herd immunity, which has absolutely no consensual scientific evidence whatsoever to support it. Strictly a hypothetical algorithmic calculation, yet we hear of herd immunity constantly, blackout of the repurposed and censored drugs that could have treated this and saved lives. So take a look around at every industry. Nuclear energy is safe. None of the plants leak it. Yes, they do. So by this reporter or this press secretary to the Biden administration, okay, you're going to censor everyone on every site that has unproven information, then you're going to have to censor every department of government. You're going to have to censor the CIA and give them no platform, get them out of business. We don't need them. And every one of the 16 intelligence agencies, all the news media, censor them, take them out of business. And all major corporations on the safety and efficacy of their product, Monsanto, et cetera, take them out of business. And those scientists purporting to proclaim that dangerous medical procedures, unproven medical procedures are fine, take them out of business, take away their medical degree. So if you're willing to do that, oh, then you're leveling the playing field. But we both know that's not going to happen. So my conclusion is just be careful about where you're getting your information, because the truth is rarely the place to get it. Or excuse me, the media is rarely the place to get it. But also be careful the sources floating around the internet, because you don't know how many of them are major provocateurs, and people are just wanting to get something out there that has no proven facts. We're out of time, everyone. Didn't get any calls. I wish I would have had you on. Look forward to having more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.